Welcome to Open Spaces. From Wyoming Public Radio News, I'm Camila Kadalska. Wyoming is the only state to feed elk every year, depending on snowpack. A newly finalized plan gets the ball rolling for reimagining what that might look like going forward.
Every little change is going to impact somebody, and that's what makes it difficult.
A federal agency wants to revoke management of lands on the Wind River Reservation. Muddy Ridge could go to the BLM or to the Northern Arapaho and Eastern Shoshone tribes.
It's reservation land. It never should have been opened up for a reclamation project in the first place.
Plus, we learn about how Wyoming judges are dealing with the rise of threats. Those stories and more coming up on Open Spaces from Wyoming Public Radio News.
Did you know that all six episodes of Human Nature's latest season are out right now? That's right. Season 9 of our award-winning podcast has a little bit of everything. A Wyoming man who spent his summer working as a night shepherd in Switzerland.
All I could hear was my breathing and the steps, and everything was so dark. And I just thought, okay, this must be what it's like to be an astronaut on the moon.
The story of one of the biggest animal rescues in history.
And I picked up the phone and they said, when can you get here? And so the next day, I actually took a plane because it never occurred to me what was ahead for me over the next few weeks.
And a woman who followed the gray whale migration hundreds of miles with her son.
I was exhausted one evening, fed up of trying to work. I'd had a really bad day. And so I was like, right, I'm not working. I'm going to read about whales.
Find Human Nature on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. That's Human Nature, one word, one N.
Welcome to Open Spaces. From Wyoming Public Radio News, I'm Camila Kadalska. Threats against judges are on the rise in Wyoming and nationwide. Whether it's a defendant attacking a judge in Clark County, Nevada, or a defendant in Wyoming threatening to rape a judge in court, some citizens have become increasingly bold in their interactions with judges, court staff, jurors, and their families. Wyoming Supreme Court Justice Kate Fox said she's alarmed by the trends. So when a bill meant to enhance protections for judges began working its way through the U.S. Congress, she felt some relief. If passed, the bill will provide increased resources to the State Justice Institute, a service organization dedicated to solving problems faced by the state courts around the nation. But she's not just waiting. She's working on solutions to the problem here in the state. Wyoming Public Radio's David Dudley spoke with Justice Fox.
What kind of problems are you facing here in Wyoming?
In Wyoming, just like across the whole nation, we're seeing more and more threats against judges. We have not, luckily, had shootings or physical attacks here in Wyoming, but those have occurred in many other states. And so we think it's our responsibility to take whatever steps we can to prevent harm, not only to judges, but to court staff, to jurors, to the public that should have access to and from our courtrooms.
And how long have you been a judge?
I have been a justice for 10 years.
During that time, have you faced any threats?
Personally, I have not. On the Supreme Court, we only hear appeals. And so we don't have the interaction with the public or with the parties that the trial courts have, because typically a Supreme Court argument is presented by the attorneys, and so we don't see the witnesses, we don't see the person who's being told that they're not going to have custody of their children. It's the trial court judges who have a lot more interaction and who tend to get a lot more threats of violence.
These don't always, the threats, they don't always stay in the courtroom, is that correct?
That's correct. We have judges in all of our counties, just about. And, you know, in Wyoming, we have pretty small communities. People tend to know where the judges live. Sometimes they show up at their homes. Sometimes they see them in the parking lot of the supermarket. And so that means that the threats aren't just to judges, they're to their families, their neighbors, and then, as I mentioned already, to all the court staff, all the people who use the courthouses around the state of Wyoming.
What will this bill provide?
It will provide resources to an organization called the State Justice Institute, which is an organization that we've worked with over the years that provides resources for various things. And so through the SJI grants, we would be able to have enhanced court security measures here in Wyoming. But at the same time, I don't want to rely completely on this federal money. I think that, and it's something that we've been working on in our courts and with the Wyoming legislature, to make sure that we do have better court security throughout Wyoming, regardless of what Congress does on this bill.
And when you say better security, what does that look like?
Well, there are a number of things that would enhance judicial security. One of the complicating factors is that our trial courts, so district courts and circuit courts, are housed in county buildings. So we don't own the building, and we can't dictate, for example, how many entrances there are. We have really good relationships with the county commissioners who host our courts in their buildings, and we also have good relationships with the sheriffs who provide the security for our courts. But they, of course, the counties and the sheriffs, have many other duties than protecting judges and the court users, and limited resources as well. So there are really two main fronts that we're working on. One is to provide physical security, so things like secure entrances, and not too many entrances. Our old courthouses had a lot of entrances and exits, and that doesn't work anymore because we need to be able to monitor who comes in. Ideally, you saw when you came in this courthouse, there's the magnetometer to make sure you're not coming in armed. And then the other thing is to have personnel, to have sheriff's deputies in the courtrooms, especially in cases that have the potential to be inflammatory. So to be able to hit the button and get security in a timely manner when there's something dangerous going on, and that requires manpower. The other thing we're working on, we actually did get a little bit of funding to help judges scrub their personal information from the internet so that they can't be found, you know, so that, for example, your home address and your children's names aren't available for people who may want to hurt you. So there are a lot of fronts that we're working on. This federal bill would give us more resources to continue that, but whether or not that bill succeeds, we need to keep working on it here in Wyoming.
That was Wyoming Public Radio's David Dudley speaking with Wyoming Supreme Court Justice Kate Fox on the rise of threats against judges. The Wyoming legislature passed a bill this year funding a 5-year forensic genetic genealogy pilot program. The technology is essentially a reverse 23andMe.
Instead of starting with, I know who I am and I want to see my relatives, it starts from, I don't know who the person is I'm looking for, but I'm going to work backward and find them.
Wyoming Public Radio's Hannah Haberman has more on how the new funding might bring closure to unsolved cases throughout the state.
Rita Curran was murdered in Burlington on July 19th or 20th in 1971. That's 18,844 days ago.
At a press conference in Burlington, Vermont last February, Police Chief John Murad addressed a somber room.
She was a teacher and a singer and a giver, and she was loved.
Lieutenant James Treve explained how justice came more than 50 years later, thanks to a cigarette butt.
It was a Lark cigarette butt. And that's all they had. It was just a brand name, but they collected it anyway, not knowing what DNA was going to be for another 15 years. That cigarette butt sat in evidence for over 40 years.
DNA from the cigarette was extracted and put into CODIS, a database that has DNA profiles from convicted offenders. But it came back without a match. So they sent it to a lab to use a technology that's been making waves in the world of cold cases, forensic genetic genealogy, or FGG.
And they had to resequence it to have it entered into an open source DNA database, Family Tree and GEDmatch.
The investigators were then able to basically trace backwards through family trees created by open source data, and ultimately close the case. Now, that same technology will be used to solve more cold cases in Wyoming. The 5-year pilot program will be run by the state's Division of Criminal Investigations, or DCI. It was originally introduced to help address the missing and murdered Indigenous persons crisis throughout the state.
Genetic genealogy is a powerful tool, and it can really solve some crimes, both criminal and humanitarian, and it's an expensive thing to do.
That's Scott McWilliams, the deputy director of the division's State Crime Lab. He says the process can cost anywhere from $3,000 to $10,000 per item in a case, so it's really only used for two types of serious crimes.
There's the side of finding perpetrators that are associated with crimes, and there's the side of identifying persons that are victims that are unidentified.
According to the Department of Justice, the tool should be used to investigate violent crimes, which they define as homicides or sex crimes. McWilliams says that having more access to funds for FGG will help them use the tool more often.
You can identify up to people in your family tree that are removed 5 times, and we can only really identify first-degree relatives here at our laboratory.
Kara Chambers is the director for the state's Division of Victim Services. She says the funding can be used by DCI directly and can also be used for grants for other local law enforcement agencies throughout the state.
If you build it, they will come. We really don't know how many cases where this could make a difference are out there.
Chambers says the FGG bill goes hand in hand with another bill that passed this session, which creates a cold case database for the state.
It's not just cold case homicides, it's cold case sexual assault. And quite frankly, that is the larger number of cold cases in our state.
Chambers is also the chair of the state's Missing and Murdered Indigenous Persons Task Force. She says that although the FGG bill originally came out of the Select Committee on Tribal Relations, the money can't be used for cases on the Wind River Reservation.
How this money will be utilized for tribal cases is in that it's very clearly for cases that occurred within state jurisdiction. So I'll just be blunt, off the reservation, right?
The Wind River Reservation is home to 2 sovereign nations. So criminal cases there are investigated by tribal law enforcement and the federal government.
The feds have resources beyond our little pilot project. And so we really hope for there's a collaboration.
Anita Roman, who's the Northern Arapaho tribal liaison for Governor Gordon, testified while the bill was being debated that it would still help with cases involving Native community members off the reservation.
Of the 8 people that I know personally that I had dinner with that were murdered, I think 5 of them were actually found in Riverton and in Lander. So not I think, I know.
Chambers says she's trying to start saying long-term open cases rather than cold cases. And she's hopeful that the new FGG funding and database will help bring closure to families still looking for justice.
And I know we have victims whose parents are now in their 80s and 90s and of a very advanced age. And they care. Sorry, I get choked up because they care. You know, they show up.
DCI is working with the state's attorney general to figure out best practices for the new technology. Both bills will go into effect on July 1st of this year. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Hannah Haberman.
Up next, we learn about a piece of land that might be returned to Wind River Reservation. This is Open Spaces.
This is Classical Wyoming, with great music 24 hours every day. If you would like to see the playlist, go to classicalwyoming.org.
Hi, Daryl Brogdon here, host of the Retro Cocktail Hour, inviting you to join me for the music that's always served up shaken, not stirred. Whether it's TV crime jazz or tiki tunes, space age bachelor pad music, swinging soundtracks, or other incredibly strange music, it's on the Retro Cocktail Hour. Saturday night at 6 on Wyoming Public Radio.
Welcome back to Open Spaces. The Bureau of Reclamation is trying to part ways with just under 60,000 acres of federal land on the Wind River Reservation. The land was originally removed from the reservation as part of the Riverton Reclamation Project in 1905. The project aimed to turn Muddy Ridge into arable farmland, but it didn't work out. Even though the land wasn't used for the project, the federal government didn't return it to the Eastern Shoshone and Northern Arapaho tribes. Now, a portion of Muddy Ridge could go to either the Bureau of Land Management or to the tribes, who say they want it back. Wyoming Public Radio's Chris Clements speaks with Wes Martell, an Eastern Shoshone tribal member who spent decades in the tribe's government.
First of all, thank you for being here with me today.
Mm-hmm.
So what are your thoughts on the news that the Bureau of Reclamation is trying to give up management of part of Muddy Ridge and that it could go to either the BLM or the Eastern Shoshone and Northern Arapaho tribes? I mean, do you think that it should be repatriated to the tribes?
Of course, it's reservation land. It never should have been opened up for a reclamation project in the first place. The Treaty of 1863, we had 44 million acres. 5 years later, Dwoski was able to negotiate the 2.5 million acres that we have right now. And General Frederick Lander didn't want us here. He wanted to move us clear up north on the other side of the Owl Creeks. And so at least Dwoski had enough influence at that time where we were able to acquire this under the Treaty of 1868. So in the Christian colonial conniving, they couldn't, what they couldn't get by negotiating through a treaty, they went kind of behind the back and came up with a Reclamation Act, which opened up all the land north of the Big Wind, which is 1.4 million acres, about 1.4 million acres of the res. After the treaty was signed, just the more you think about it, the more you think about this whole doctrine of discovery and what the federal government and attorneys have done to us, we've really got to stand up for ourselves. We have to protect what little we have. There should be no question that that land reverts back to the tribes. And in 1943, there was actually a letter that said that from the Bureau of Reclamation to the Indian Office. Officially, a letter has said this land is excess to the project and should be returned to the In fact, the words and the actual wording of the letter said should be restored to tribal ownership. Normally, they say should be returned to the BIA and trust for the tribes.
Would you be able to describe just to me and like listeners what this part of Muddy Ridge, I know it's 60,000 acres, on Muddy Ridge. Could you tell us a bit about what it looks like?
It's kind of buttes and bluffs and hilly and desert-looking in some areas and pretty dry here and there, but it's, you know, those types of areas are very important to us, not only to culture and tradition, but there's a lot of our traditional medicines and plants and foods. A lot of our relations that grew out in that country.
So in a recent news report, some ranchers near Muddy Ridge have said they're afraid they won't be able to keep their grazing permits for cattle if the Eastern Shoshone and Northern Arapaho become land trustees of the area and Midvale Irrigation District stops managing it. Do you think that their concerns are valid there, or what do you think of that?
It wasn't designated for grazing. That's a violation of the act. That wasn't created for grazing. It was created for agriculture.
Ranchers have said that if the BIA manages Muddy Ridge on the tribe's behalf, it could impose like restricted grazing strategies more broadly, which these folks don't want. Is that something that you think might happen?
Could.
So do you oppose the grazing that's going on right now? These folks who are grazing cattle?
Well, like I said, that wasn't the purpose of the land. It wasn't made for grazing. It might be a good grazing land, but that's not a purpose of what the Reclamation Act was established for.
How might the two tribes manage the land in Muddy Ridge differently if it was returned to them? I mean, what might the return mean for tribal members across the reservation?
You know, there's hunting and gathering and cultural and archaeological resources out there that are very important to us. And we're very spiritually connected to a lot of those areas of land. A lot of our elders have lived out there in some of those areas. There used to be a silver mine up in the mountains up there at one time. And I actually found, I was up there hunting one time just north of this area. And the water that came out of that silver mine was an old log water pipe made out of wood. It was, and then it had wire wrapped all around it, coiled all around it. But it was a perfectly round water pipe made out of wood. And we found some of that up there, you know. And so, you know, this is the Aboriginal homelands of the Eastern Shoshone tribe and many other tribes. There's a lot of meaning to that land to us, spiritually, culturally, and economically at some point. And we got an adjudicated water right. And when the water starts getting shortage, there's definitely going to have to be some change of plans. And how do we manage our lands? And how do we consider grazing and agriculture in all areas of our land? And so that's really, you know, the way things are going right now, of course there's going to be change. We all have to change. We have to adapt. And we're just trying to protect what little we have left. You know, it's like, we had 44 million acres at one time. Now we're down to about 2,220,000.
Well, thank you so much for talking with me today, Wes.
All right. Take care of yourself.
That was a conversation between Wyoming Public Radio's Chris Clemens and former Eastern Shoshone Council member Wes Martell. Wyoming is the only state in the country that has a winter feeding program for elk as part of its management plan. There is 22 feed grounds across the western part of the state. It's been going on for about 100 years. It started as a way to help elk through hard winters and to keep them off ranches. And the elk have come to depend on it. But now the state says it can't go on the way it always has because of a deadly disease that spreads when elk congregate. A plan was recently finalized to reduce elk's reliance on feed grounds, but the specifics of how it will all be done are still unclear. It's tricky and controversial, and no other state has had to do this. Wyoming Public Radio's Caitlin Tan visited a feed ground in late March.
Elk feeder James Barnes leads two stout 1,800-pound draft horses on an elk feed ground in Alpine, Wyoming.
Her name's Robin, and this is a gelding. His name is Batman. So Robin and Batman make a pretty good team.
Robin and Batman pull a sleigh every day through the winter, loaded down with hay to feed the 400 elk. Barnes has worked here on and off for the last 14 years. And you can tell, he confidently hooks the horses up to the long, flat sleigh. Whoa. Whoa. Barnes climbs on, and they're off.
Hanging on? Yep. Gotta jerk it out of the ice.
With him is Feed Grounds manager Gary Hornberger. The two stack hay bales onto the sleigh.
Here, if you'll put seven total on top of those two, that'll be 35.
Okay.
Should be enough on top there.
Yep.
And they take off to feed the elk, who are watching intently in the distance. But all this could eventually change, as Wyoming is taking a hard look at its program. The end goal isn't to close feed grounds, but to reduce elk's reliance on being fed hay. Stakeholders have spent years trying to craft a plan to do so, and at a recent Game and Fish Commission meeting in Pinedale, they discussed the details.
I'm Cheyenne Stewart, the Wildlife Management Coordinator for Jackson.
Stewart speaks to the commissioners in a crowded room filled with cowboy and hiking boots, Carhartt vests, and tension, which can be described by a quote Stewart reads about feed grounds.
What started as a logical solution to some very real problems has become one of the most complex and controversial wildlife management challenges of the 21st century.
A lot of elk could die trying to adjust to no supplemental feed, and the ones that don't could possibly damage private property. But the agency has to do something because of chronic wasting disease, or CWD. Stewart shows a map of CWD first appearing in southeast Wyoming in 1986, indicated by a small pink blob. But as she scrolls through the years, the pink blob grows.
And you can kind of see how CWD is marching its way towards the feed ground system.
To date, there's been 4 cases of CWD in feed ground herd units. And some projections say if it takes hold, CWD could possibly wipe out half the population of feed ground elk in western Wyoming. So that's why the Game and Fish are itching to get ahead of the disease. They created this 100-page plan to reduce reliance on feed grounds with a lengthy list of caveats. Like, it can't affect things like hunting, elk population objectives, and ranchers' bottom line. And even still, it's pretty controversial.
I got bogged down and I just quit reading it, got frustrated.
Dustin Child is a longtime outfitter from Cokeville.
And I powered through and got to page 50. And that's when I really started to hit the meat and potatoes of what is in this. And I had some serious concern.
He's concerned that this plan is giving the agency authority to manage less elk on the landscape, which he worries will hurt hunting.
Elk is what we have. Let's not mess that up. Let's proceed with caution.
But commissioners say they are being cautious and will only make changes the public supports. So with this overarching plan, it basically sets the stage to make, well, more plans. For the next few years, the agency will outline specific ideas and goals for each feed ground herd. And back at the Pinedale Game and Fish office, the agency's John Lund is working hard on this.
Every little change is going to impact somebody, and that's what makes it difficult. And if it was something that was simple, it would have been done a long time ago.
This is uncharted territory, so Lund says it could take decades. In fact, in the short term, the average person might not even notice the changes.
Maybe it's expanding a feed ground, making it larger so elk can disperse better. It might be obtaining equipment to help spread elk out, things like that.
Lund says what's important to remember is the whole reason any of this is happening is to benefit the elk. Currently, elk feeding is done for the season, and they're migrating to their summer range in the mountains. And in the meantime, it'll be up to the people to figure out what winter feeding will look like. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Caitlin Tan in Pinedale.
We learn about efforts to help wildlife cross roads and highways. That's up next on Open Spaces.
The Wyoming Public Radio app delivers great music 24/7. Stream Wyoming Sounds, Jazz Wyoming, and Classical Wyoming. Download the Wyoming Public Radio app at wyomingpublicmedia.org.
This time on The Modern West, we climb the Grand Teton exactly 100 years to the day after Eleanor Davis became the first recorded woman to ever climb it.
I really do believe courage is like a muscle.
And we do it with a bunch of women. Courage is a muscle. It's part one of our new series, High Altitude Tales. Find it under podcasts at wyomingpublicmedia.org. Sponsored by the Wyoming Women's Foundation.
Welcome back to Open Spaces. From Wyoming Public Radio News, I'm Camila Kadalska. Roads connect people and goods from point A to point B, but for animals, roads break up important areas of habitat and can interrupt migration routes. Now, a strategy to help animals is gaining traction in the West. Boise State Public Radio's Rachel Cohen reports for the Mountain West News Bureau.
Take the highway east of Boise about 30 minutes and you'll come up to a tunnel with a bridge on top.
So there's the overpass. Looks fantastic.
But the bridge is not for cars to cross over the highway, it's for animals. Metal fencing helps funnel wildlife onto the bridge and off the road. I'm here with Greg Servine. He worked for the Idaho Department of Fish and Game for 3 decades and recommended projects like this.
It's so great to see. It's been a lot of years in the making.
Idaho has a handful of tunnels to avoid wildlife vehicle collisions, but this roughly $7 million bridge is the state's first overpass. In 2016, Fish and Game counted 77 deer and elk carcasses along this highway stretch, and Boise keeps growing.
As the traffic increases, it's just going to increasingly result in more dead deer.
Servine says GPS technology has come a long way. It now gives a much better picture of how and where animals move, and it's revealed just how much roads mess up migrations. For wildlife, approaching a highway could mean approaching death or just an impassable wall of cars.
And the deer turn around and no longer make the migration, and that's the beginning of the end in terms of health of a population.
The Idaho Department of Transportation says this overpass is good for both people and animals and could reduce collisions by about 80%. All over the country, crossings are gaining traction. The federal government has pledged $350 million for building crossings over the next few years. Wyoming already has more than 30 crossings, with 10 more in the works. Utah has over 50 and has committed $20 million toward building more.
And yet, just over the border in Idaho, we're tiptoeing around these issues.
Brian Brooks is the director of the Idaho Wildlife Federation. He says Idaho is behind. A 2019 incident in eastern Idaho near the Montana border is partially to blame. ITD proposed 3 wildlife overpasses on Targhee Pass by Island Park. Some residents were skeptical about the bridges and associated fencing. They worried about impeding private property rights and access to public lands. In an advisory vote, county residents said they didn't want the crossings, and ITD scrapped them from the plans.
I was dumbfounded in some respects.
Patricia Kramer is a transportation ecologist whose research was the basis of ITD's proposal.
It's like, wait a minute, we're coming into a community saying, look, and we're going to help make your life safer.
Kramer is now working for ITD on an updated map of collision hotspots. She says the Targhee Pass dispute has had a lasting effect, at least in this area.
That experience totally has affected both the wildlife and transportation agencies, and they're very hesitant to suggest any wildlife crossings.
But Jacob Gray with Fish and Game in eastern Idaho says that's not necessarily a bad thing. Community input is important.
That's a key foundation to where we want to work in Idaho. We want to work where people want the work done.
Still, advocates worry what that could mean for wildlife. ITD is proposing an expansion of the same federal highway in eastern Idaho. It's a key corridor for elk, deer, and grizzly bears moving in and out of Yellowstone. It's early in the planning process, but right now, ITD is not suggesting regular wildlife crossings as part of the construction. Back at Idaho's first wildlife overpass near Boise, Servine, who retired from Fish and Game, says he hopes this bridge is the first of many.
We can do this. It's doable. I just hope we can do some catch-up here because we've got lots to do. We have tremendous elk, deer, and antelope. We need to start taking care of them.
Servine says as the state continues to grow and landscapes change with the warming climate, connecting habitat is only getting more important. Rachel Cohen, Boise State Public Radio News.
In a new series of radio diaries from Jackson Hole Community Radio, we get to know more about some of the folks that help the community thrive and what drives them to stay there. Today we hear from Alex Roberts, who leads a team of snowplow drivers in Grand Teton National Park. Snow may be melting right now, but this dispatch comes from one of the biggest storms of the season back in early March. Roberts takes us on a ride while clearing Highway 191, giving us an inside look into what goes into the job, his efforts to prioritize his crew's mental well-being, and his thoughts about what his future holds as a government employee.
My name is Alex Roberts. It's been the biggest storm that we've had this year, and we're about to go out and plow some snow.
Coming in. Thank you for coming in. Appreciate it. It's these gentlemen's days off, and they came in because it's a pretty good storm. Usually we sit around here and have a little more conversation about, all right, what needs this, what needs that. But a day like today, it's just kind of triage. Plan today as I take a bite out of my hurried lunch.
We're going to go back out on the highway, so we'll just be doing everything we can to make sure keep it as wide as we can for folks.
I'm from Columbus, Ohio, originally. Went to Ohio State University, got a degree in Parks, Rec, and Tourism Management, and then I had an opportunity to apply for National Park stuff out west. So I applied to a whole bunch of jobs with the Park Service just about everywhere and had a callback from here. And at the time, I didn't even know what Grand Teton was. So I said, well, can I have a day to think about it so I could go home and Google it? And of course, the first picture I see is, you know, the iconic Schwalbacher's Landing with a moose and the mountains in the background. And I was like, yeah, I think I could live and work there. When I wake up on a day like today, so the first things that go through my mind are making sure my staff are okay and they've got the tools that they need to safely clear the road and taking access for emergencies. So, you know, you think about if someone's out there sledding up on Togarty and has an accident, please come through this way.
411, Teton Dispatch.
And then starting to think about, like, what's the next steps?
411, County is wondering what the conditions are on 89 for an ambulance to be able to make it through to get up to Tovey Pass.
Yep, so if we are unable to keep it clear, to keep it open, if it is shut down, what are the steps we're going to need to take? It's all just kind of a, you know, educated guess. You have predictions of how it's going to go and what's going to happen. You could look at the forecast and go, yeah, okay, more snow and wind. But at the end of the day, you just got to go with what's actually presented in front of you. And just kind of take it one step at a time. Trying to find that balance of a good leader for my crew, like that's the challenge I face. I want to make sure to honor all of them as individuals and respect the work they do, and then making sure people take care of themselves, take the time off, understand that, you know, this, what we do is important, but it is just a job. Part of the reason we really have to emphasize work-life balance is I live in the park, I work in the park, I recreate in the park, like everything I do. It's like you never leave the office in a way. I'm an instructor for a National Park Service program called Operational Leadership, which is about empowering staff at all levels to speak up, especially in circumstances of safety. These days, that program is evolving into also psychological safety and personal well-being, emphasizing a see something, say something, speak up culture, an environment where people feel safe to be themselves and raise concerns when they feel otherwise has been hugely important. We're fortunate to have affordable housing close by to work. I feel so bad for folks that have to work 2 and 3 jobs just to pay rent around here to be able to stay here. While I am so fortunate to be well compensated and have affordable housing, I do often think about, I spend 30 years making this my home and my community and my foundation. What do I do, you know, when that's over? And that's been pretty tough to grapple with. I do love it here, and we're all here because, well, we love this place. Like, how could you not? But we just want everybody to respect it and love it the same way that we do. So that way it is here for future generations.
Alex Roberts leads a crew of snowplow drivers in Grand Teton National Park. That radio diary was produced by Jackson Hole Community Radio's contributor, Kieran Hadley. Next on Open Spaces, we hear about how a cartoon in Jackson went awry.
Hi, I'm Grady Kirkpatrick, inviting you to join me for Wyoming Sounds. Along with your favorites, you'll discover plenty of new music. We bring you NPR news updates, weather, and we'll let you know about events happening around Wyoming. Wyoming Sounds from 9 to noon on Wyoming Public Radio. and 24/7 online at wyomingsounds.org.
You already listen to public radio, but what if public radio could listen back? It does on the NPR One app. Hear local, national, and international news plus podcasts based on what you like. The more you listen, the more it gets to know you. Download NPR One at your app store.
Welcome back to Open Spaces. More than 100 years ago, a professor in our region invented a tool and technique to measure the amount of water in a mountain snowpack. The Mountain West News Bureau's Caleb Radel explains the importance of this discovery and why it lives on to this day.
It's a February morning in the mountains between Reno and Lake Tahoe, and I'm snowshoeing past towering green pine trees dusted with snow. I reach an area of Mount Rose where federal hydrologist Jeff Anderson is about to measure the snowpack. He's assembling a blue metal tube that stretches more than 7 feet.
These are the snow tubes. They're basically a cookie cutter that will take a core of the snowpack.
Anderson first weighs the tube without snow in it. Then he sticks the tube deep into the snowpack. He pulls it out and looks inside the end for soil.
Because that tells us we hit the ground. We didn't just hit an ice layer. So that looks pretty good. Now we're going to weigh it.
The difference in the weight of the tube with snow gives Anderson an accurate measurement of how much water is in the snowpack. And that's important for gauging water supplies for communities in our region.
It contains 16.3 inches of water content. If we were to melt that down, that's how much water would be on the ground.
This tool and technique used to measure snow water was first used more than a century ago, right here on this mountain. In the early 1900s, James Church was a professor at the University of Nevada, Reno. He taught classics, German, and art history. He also loved to be outside, in the mountains.
He started to realize the importance of snow had, and he understood how important snow was to the water supply.
That's why Church and agriculture researchers built a weather station on the summit of Mount Rose. Their goal was to better track snowfall and spring runoff data. In the process, Church developed and patented a snow tube he called the Mount Rose Sampler. It's the device still used by Anderson and hydrologists around the world.
I think that speaks to, one, how hard it is to measure snow, and two, what a good design it was.
That's Adrian Harpold. He's a professor in environmental science at the University of Nevada, Reno, and he's somewhat of a Church historian. He says that before Church created the Mount Rose Sampler, snowpack measurements focused on depth, but that invention showed how much water was in the snow and would end up in the rivers and lakes.
It's a breakthrough that still resonates today because, if anything, the value of those predictions have only gone up over time.
Mountain snowpacks are frozen reservoirs that slowly melt during spring and summer, and studies show human-caused climate change is shrinking them around the world. Harpold says the snow science pioneered by Church not only enables water managers to predict summertime water supplies for cities and farmers, it also allows emergency managers to forecast floods and droughts.
The value of that small piece of metal that he invented is probably literally billions of dollars over the last 100 years.
Back on Mount Rose, clouds are swallowing up the sun and snow flurries are floating down at the snowpack measurement site. Federal Watermaster Chad Blanchard is there waiting for the results. He manages water levels and releases at 4 major reservoirs on the Truckee River.
This whole process of snow survey is critical to managing water supplies throughout the West or throughout the world.
Jeff Anderson, the hydrologist we heard from earlier, says Church's groundbreaking work in the early 1900s became the backbone of water management in the West.
By the 20s, which is only like 10 years after he developed the snow tubes, it had already spread to other states across the West.
And in 1935, after a year of severe drought, the federal government created a Western Snow Survey and Water Supply Forecasting Program. Anderson says it was based entirely on Church's techniques.
I kind of see him as many people in the Tahoe region that want to somehow combine their passion for being outdoors with their career, and he did that.
A century later, newer technologies can measure the amount of water in the snow crunching beneath me, It can be done automatically at remote weather stations called snowtell sites. But Anderson says Church laid the groundwork for modern snow science. And if the data needs to be double-checked, he still breaks out his trusty Mount Rose sampler. For the Mountain West News Bureau, I'm Caleb Bradle.
And staying in the winter world, there's a lot of tension in ski towns across our region. Roads are more crowded and prices are rising everywhere, especially for housing. It doesn't take much for that tension to boil over. Jackson Hole Community Radio's Dante Filppula-Ankeny reports on a comic strip controversy.
Ryan Stolpe's newspaper comic is due in 30 minutes, but he doesn't know what he's going to draw. He consults his half-baked list of ideas and then grabs his iPad.
I would love to tell you that I think these through more than I do, but.
But he has no time to. Stick figure here, sketch there, speech bubble, color, and done. He sends it off to the paper just in time.
And that's how Jackson, at least, gets a Liflines.
Liflines is Stolpe's satirical comic that riffs on ski culture and the lifestyle in mountain towns like Jackson. It runs 3 times a week in the town's daily paper as well as on Instagram to his 15,000 followers. But this spring, one of his comics drew community outrage, unlike any he's done before.
I knew there was this little secret, so I'm like, okay, I can fly kind of close to the sun and I can make this joke.
The secret exposed a hack that allowed locals to avoid a $35 daily parking fee in a lot at the base of Jackson Hole Mountain Resort. The lot offered a way to avoid an about hour-long bus ride to the resort. So dozens, if not hundreds, of locals had been using the hack by quickly scanning their ticket.
And so I kind of felt like I stepped on a landmine that I didn't know was there.
Soon after the comic ran, the group that runs the parking lot cracked down. No more hack, no more free parking. Locals were not amused. Suddenly, Stolpe was targeted by spam callers and the Jehovah's Witnesses, a setup he suspects was sparked by angry locals. And among the hundreds of angry Instagram comments, he was described as public enemy number one and warned that he would get punched in the face.
It's different when everyone that's mad is like your neighbor and your community member and your friend or your friend of a friend.
$35 might not seem like much, but the incident highlights a friction in ski towns across the Mountain West. Skiing and snowboarding continues to grow, bringing more people to resort towns. And that drives up prices on housing, meals, lift tickets, almost everything. Many residents are feeling the squeeze.
Resort and tourism-based communities have very unique challenges, such as high cost of living, affordable housing issues, and transportation is very much a ski town issue.
That's Margaret Bowes, executive director of the Colorado Association of Ski Towns. She says parking fees and parking tickets aim to steer people to carpools and shuttles. Still, the charges can rankle residents who long for the good old days. Julian LaCourse, who worked as a bartender in town, has felt that friction. He used the parking hack hundreds of times and saw nothing wrong with using something that was widely available, at least to those who knew.
I don't think it's possible to steal something when it's allowed.
He considers Stolpe a friend, but wishes the cartoonist had apologized. He thinks a lot of the blowback was deserved, but also that many went too far.
Any calls to violence are outlandish. That's ridiculous, guys.
Stolpe attributes the blowback to folks who are frustrated about changes in town and are looking for a scapegoat.
I think the thing that you have an obligation to do, no matter where you are in that community, is to be a role model and steward how that community should evolve, because all things change.
Recently, he was back on the mountain.
Beautiful sunrise on Tetons this morning.
There's a mountain host and their ski patrol at the top of the tram. If you have any questions...
After riding the tram towards the top of Rendezvous Mountain, he straps on his skis in front of Corbett's cabin.
I think the community showed its true colors in the end, and the true colors were good. That's why I live here. That's why I love living here. There's great people around every corner.
And down into the bowl he goes. Dante Filppula-Ankeny, KHOL News.
Thank you for listening to Open Spaces. The entire show and all the stories you heard here can be found on our website at wyomingpublicmedia.org. We can also be found wherever you get your podcasts, and we post all our stories on the station's social media platforms. Thanks to Hannah Haberman, our audio producer, and Ivy Engel, our digital and social media producer. Open Spaces is a production of Wyoming Public Radio News.